Chief Justice Steele and members of the court, it's a pleasure to appear in front of you today to explain the three principal errors in the trial court's opinion, which should lead the court to reverse and remand for a new determination of the entire fairness of the challenge transaction. First, I will explain how the trial court erred in dealing with Hallmark, a controlling stockholder, as a simple, independent, third-party holder of debt, and in its treatment of the Hallmark threat to put Crown into bankruptcy. Secondly, I will attempt to explain how the application of the entire fairness test in this context fell woefully short of the level of critical scrutiny demanded by the decisions of this court. Third, I will explain how the trial court failed to apply generally accepted valuation techniques in accepting the defendant's valuations, how it erred as a matter of law in failing to require a valuation from the defendants as of the date of the recap, and how the use of the irrelevant and outdated cluster valuations was further legal error. All of these problems, or any of them, individually or in combination, justify a reversal and a remand from our perspective. The first major problem with the opinion relates to the acceptance of Hallmark as a third-party debt holder. Hallmark, of course, had two hats in this context. It was a holder of a majority of the voting power, a controller of a majority of the board seats, and separately, it held a substantial amount of the debt of a highly leveraged company. Wearing these two hats put Hallmark in a unique position, not previously addressed by this court or by the Chancery Court, and in the sense it went from being the 800-pound gorilla that this court is worried about in such decisions as Citron and in Conn versus Lynch, to what we refer to as the 1,600-pound gorilla because of the dual capacities in which it operated and its opportunity to influence the outcome of the process. For decades, this court has been emphasizing the subtle ways in which a controlling stockholder can influence the outcome of a self-interested transaction because of its indirect power to influence the decision makers. Here, unlike all of your other entire fairness cases, Hallmark possessed extra power, doubly excessive power, as the debt holder to induce the committee to accept the Hallmark position on the recap. And from our perspective, the outcome here proves the point. Three committee members, owning not one share of Crown stock, approved without a minority stockholder approval requirement, and with full knowledge that the minority stockholders would vote down the recap proposal from Hallmark, a recap proposal at a clearly and admittedly reverse-engineered price that was not the subject of independent negotiation or an intrinsic valuation analysis. The related problem with the trial court opinion is the assessment that Crown's equity was worthless because Crown was on the verge of bankruptcy or was insolvent. The resulting mistake dominated the opinion and allowed the court to repeatedly assess Crown's equity as worthless.
Let me ask you a question on your last statement. There's no appeal of the fair process determination, is there?
The primary focus of the appeal is on the inadequacy of the fair price determination, but as I'll get to, we think there are issues this court should consider with respect to the fairness of the price, fairness of the process determination by the trial court as well. But you're right, the primary focus of the argument is on the unfair, on the fair price determination.
The fair process appeal?
We do outline a number of factors which we believe show the unfairness of the process here, which we would urge the court to take into account in assessing the fairness of the price. The real problem here is that the fact-finding with respect to Crown being on the verge of bankruptcy was inconsistent with the overwhelming weight of the evidence. Crown's insolvency or bankruptcy was never a realistic possibility, and there are multiple reasons which were on the record and which, equally important from our perspective, were not advanced by the defendants to show that Hallmark would never permit Crown to become insolvent or bankrupt.
Could I interrupt for a moment? My understanding is that for many years, Crown had been unable to pay the debt service on the outstanding debt. Is that correct?
Yes, interest was accruing.
And that Hallmark, for year after year, granted an extension as a matter of grace, not because it had to, but apparently to keep Crown going for a while.
That's right? The debt waiver agreement we refer to in the papers.
Okay. So if that's the case, how can you argue that the trial court was wrong in saying that Crown was unable to pay its debts when they became due?
A, Crown was not insolvent at the time to anybody other than potentially to Hallmark. The debt had not yet matured. But most importantly, the trial court should have recognized that Crown had two very viable alternatives here. It could have proceeded with a debt waiver for another year and thereby took advantage of its expanding EBITDA to put itself in a position to fully service the debt. That's the fundamental mistake that the committee made in not understanding that it had the power to say no. And for the reasons we explained in our papers, we don't think Hallmark had any plans to put this company into bankruptcy. In addition, the core problem, the second alternative, of course, was to do a recap at a fair price. And we're perfectly fine with a recap, but it had to be done in a procedurally fair fashion, and most importantly, it had to be done at an economically fair price. Neither of those criteria were satisfied, and the trial court erred in finding to the contrary as a result of its insufficient application of entire fairness scrutiny.
Abrams, I'm having a little trouble understanding precisely what your position is. In your opening brief, your lead argument was that the trial court erred in concluding that the company would be put in bankruptcy. The response to that was that's not the issue. That is, whether or not the company would be put into formal bankruptcy was beside the point. The point was that the company was insolvent, which meant that its equity had zero value. That's a fact determination. That is the value. And if it's correct, that is, if it's upheld, we would have to affirm, would we not?
We regard that as a legal and economic conclusion by the court and not a fact-based determination.
How do you get from fact to law when you're putting a number such as zero on the value of the equity?
That's a conclusion which was driven by the court's legal and economic analysis of the situation, and it is only a truism. By definition, every highly leveraged company is going to depend upon the waivers granted by a controlling stockholder and the simultaneous holder of the debt. The problem with the opinion is it creates what we refer to as the ticking time bomb. If this opinion is accepted, every controlling stockholder holds the power to convert the debt, and by definition, under the approach that the equity is worthless,
1,600-pound gorilla that's holding the ticking time bomb.
It's either one.
Let me just continue then. The argument, the responsive argument was, what we're talking about here is insolvency, not bankruptcy. Now you're arguing, that is, you're conjoining both insolvency and bankruptcy and friendly attacking the bankruptcy finding. Is that correct?
We disagree with the findings of the court. Yeah, and legally and economically on both bankruptcy and insolvency.
And not only do you disagree, but it's essential that you attack the insolvency finding. Is that correct?
We argue in the alternative. First, we don't think it is factually permissible for the trial court to conclude on this record that there was any possibility that Hallmark would ever put Crown into bankruptcy or call the debt and render it insolvent. Secondly, in the alternative, if you credit the Hallmark threat, then we have the prototypical coercive threat by a controlling stockholder, which means the special committee process can't be given legal effect, and you're still required in the alternative, even if you accept the bankruptcy proposition, to critically assess the fairness of the process and price. The special committee approval, regardless of whether you give it credit or not,
the lower court was required to find on this record that there was no risk that Hallmark would ever call its debt.
We explain at length in our papers the multiple reasons without rebuttal.
Is that a yes?
I'm sorry, maybe I misunderstood
you,
Your Honor's question.
You argue, and I understand the argument to be that the lower court erred, as a matter of fact or law or both, in finding that Hallmark would have or could have called its debt.
Yes.
Your argument is that it's the opposite finding that was compelled as a matter of law. Is that a fair characterization of your position?
We argue as a matter of fact that the insolvency and bankruptcy threats were shams or smokescreens, and the trial court fact-finding was incorrect on the record. In the alternative, we argue that if you credit the Hallmark threat, then under Citron or Conn versus Lynch, that's a threat which disabled the special committee and still leaves the trial court with the opportunity and obligation under an entire fairness standard to assess the fairness of the price. And we argue for multiple reasons that the economic determination of the fair price was counterintuitive, given the debt exchange, violated generally accepted valuation techniques, and was based upon the irrelevant and outdated cluster. So from our perspective, the trial court's wrong as a matter of fact on bankruptcy and insolvency, and if it's right, you still have to make the entire fairness determination and assess all of our arguments with respect to the errors made by their experts and by the trial court in performing the valuation for the fair price inquiry. So the only logical conclusion we see here is that Hallmark used the threat of bankruptcy insolvency to approve an unfair debt exchange offer. We think the trial court blinded itself in making those determinations and adopting a framework for this case, which, you know, once you start with equity is worthless by definition, you have to come out their way with respect to the assessment of the methodologies.
In some of our prior entire fairness opinions, we looked at whether or not anyone had conducted a market check. And in this particular case, as I understand the record, Wachtell was hired and other experts were consulted, and they really tried to sell Crown, and they were unsuccessful in doing that. Now, I realize your expert came in with a valuation around $3 billion, but there's indications in the trial court's opinion that the value never would have exceeded the debt. What's the relevance of these efforts to sell the company that were unsuccessful in looking at the valuation?
They're completely irrelevant because they preceded by 2 years or more the recap. Crown was in a much different economic position at the time of the recap than it was at the time of the prior sale efforts.
Well, the related question on the market check, though, is that once the recap was done, it was filed publicly, and we also have opinions to say when a deal is known, sometimes it generates other interest, and in this case, the deal was known, and no other interest was generated, and the argument made by your opponents is if the company was worth $3 billion, once this deal was known, someone would have come forward to take advantage of it.
That argument doesn't fly at all. The key issue here is Hallmark's control over Crown. Was there a Hallmark press release saying that Hallmark was willing to consider strategic options for Crown? Absolutely not. You had Crown announcing the terms of a recap and in a throw-in sentence saying it's willing to consider other options. But nobody in the marketplace is going to consider Crown to be for sale when the controlling stockholder has not evidenced, publicly or privately, any notion that it's willing to sell the company. Moreover, we don't know what the outcome of a sale process would be because this special committee and Morgan Stanley never tested the waters. They didn't ask to pursue third-party financing. Instead, they accepted the glib response of a senior investment banker who we think was clearly incentivized under his engagement letter to get this recap done.
The process, if they couldn't service the existing debt, how could they have acquired third-party financing?
Third-party financing proposals were inquiries were made in conjunction with it, with the recap process. They turned it down. That's one of the, they didn't even open the door to consider them. Crown had turned EBITDA positive a year after the recap was going to be consummated. It was expected to get $116 million in EBITDA. That's plenty of money in today's low interest rate environment to service $1.2 billion of debt or such lesser amount as might have been outstanding after a fairly priced recap. There are tons of process-related problems here which should have set off the alarm bells in the Chancellor's mind with respect to what happened. We have committee members owning no stock. How many times have all of us seen a situation where they had the committee members had zero skin in the game, and nevertheless, they approved, without a majority of the minority vote, a deal they knew would have been voted down, and they threw away the minority vote for no additional economic consideration? They never considered the alternative seriously, which would give them the leverage to negotiate at arm's length with Hallmark. They decided that they had no option other than to deal with Hallmark, and they lost sight of their power to say no to an unfair transaction. The committee conceded on every material point to Hallmark, including giving up the minority vote, not getting anything for it, and agreeing to give Hallmark a 90.1% interest in Crown. The 259 debt conversion price should have been a non-starter to the court. It's admitted, it's undisputed, 259 was reverse engineered by Hallmark to make sure it got to the 90.1% interest. Most importantly, and quite surprisingly to me, the trial court was totally blind to the economic implications of a controlling stockholder being willing to exchange debt for equity. No rational economic actor would exchange a senior secured position in debt and take equity unless he believed that the equity was valuable. The trial court finding and all of the litigation-driven arguments about the equity being worthless fail miserably in light of the common sense recognition that Hallmark had to have believed that the equity had value. We've asked defendants continuously in the pretrial briefs, at trial, we asked their witnesses at trial, we raised the question again in the papers. We've never heard an answer, the trial court didn't hear an answer, and I predict you won't hear a satisfactory answer to the question of how debt could be viewed as worthless at a time when a controller is willing to exchange more than $800 million of debt for equity. The fair price finding is equally bewildering to me because the trial court accepted valuations proffered by the defendants, not one of which had anything to do with the effective date of the recap. We looked hard to try and find a single entire fairness case decided by this court or by the trial court in which the court found that a price was entirely fair and in the defendant's favor without the defendants putting in an expert report assessing the fairness of the price as of the date of the challenge transaction. We don't have it. It's not cited in their papers. We think that's a severe evidentiary problem that the trial court overlooked. The real problem with this opinion is that it stands in complete contrast to the careful scrutiny and powerful inquiry that's mandated under an entire fairness inquiry. If you take this opinion with any of the examples that you're familiar with from this court or the trial court, and you look at the level of inquiry and the assessment, and it falls, in our view, critically short. If we compare this decision, for example, to the most recent decision from the trial court in southern Peru, the level of the focused assessment in southern Peru in comparison to this case is completely missing. Entire fairness requires judicial second-guessing of every decision made by the controller, the committee, their valuation experts, and a critical assessment of the negotiations and outcome. That's not what happened here. The court blinded itself by accepting the bankruptcy insolvency proposition and then accepting irrelevant, outdated, and mistake-filled valuations to justify its conclusion. The list of parallels between our case and southern Peru is astonishing. When you look at southern Peru, it was a transaction approved by an overwhelming majority of the minority stockholders. We never even got that vote. We had people who own no stock dealing with our clients' economic and the class interests in a way that made no fundamental economic sense given the willingness of the controlling stockholder to exchange. From our perspective, entire fairness requires an extremely vigorous, exacting form of judicial review, and unfortunately none of the facets of the entire fairness inquiry are present in this case. Two related points pertaining to the valuations. It's very clear that the Morgan Stanley and Houlihan valuations were performed in violation of generally accepted valuation practices. We made the arguments in the brief, and it's a black and white question. These determinations on the fair price inquiry do not require any judicial deference from you. These are open and shut, treatise-driven, non-subjective determinations. A subjective decision deserving credibility might be the selection of an earnings multiplier, the selection of a methodology, or the weighting of a methodology. That's not what's going on here. These people had the ability to look in the books, just like our experts did, and to figure out the objective, correct way to do the DCF valuation. They didn't do it. That was our experts' testimony, and equally important, their own experts admitted they didn't do it. There's a lot of money at stake here.
And you mentioned that in the Southern Peru case, is that the name it goes by? I don't see it in your table of authorities.
That was an opinion issued by Chancellor Strine immediately after the completion of briefing in this case, which we'd be happy to submit to your honors.
All right, so I'm correct that you didn't cite it and you didn't submit it ahead of time.
That's correct. It's a post-briefing submission that is one of many examples of Chancery Court rulings in the entire fairness area, which reflect a focused inquiry that's markedly absent here. With respect to the clustered valuations, it's beyond me to understand how the trial court could believe that unaccepted, non-negotiated offers by third parties out to steal the company that occurred years ago when Crown was a markedly different company could supposedly evidence the fair value of the company. We demolished the Morgan Stanley and the Houlihan valuations, so we're left with a very difficult situation.
And how is that done? By your own expert?
Yes, we demonstrated that they didn't calculate the WACC correctly, they didn't calculate the perpetuity growth rate correctly, and they didn't step down the cash flows in order to get to avoid what we described as the cliff-like problem on the cash flows. Those are the three black and white errors in the valuation analysis that take Morgan Stanley and Houlihan off the table. So what's the trial court left with? The clusters of other valuations of stale non-negotiated offers, comparable company and comparable transactions that even their own experts admitted aren't comparable.
Are you referring to the graph?
Yes. You go through that graph, they're outdated, they're wrong, they're non-negotiated, non-accepted offers. The trial court even accepted as evidence of value what Evercore, the financial advisor to Hallmark, advised as to what the true value is. None of these are competent evidence of value. The trial court erred by not looking at the only competent evidence presented as of the date of the recap, our expert's report, and in assessing whether the building blocks of our expert's report were individually correct. Instead, the trial court erred because it simply accepted the what we call the equity is worthless notion and then proceeding to reject without a focused explanation or seasoned analysis all of the valuations relied upon by the defendants.
Mr. Abrams, is it accurate to say that in order for this court to reverse, we would have to overturn one or more of the Court of Chancery's factual findings?
Absolutely not.
We could reverse accepting all the factual findings?
Yes. You can accept. I think the bankruptcy insolvency finding is wrong as a matter of fact. But if it's right, that only gets the trial court into a position where it still has to assess the entire fairness of the transaction.
If what you say is true, should we find that the finding of insolvency was a factual finding, on what legal basis do we reverse?
I referred previously to the truism that a highly leveraged company, by definition, is always insolvent or potentially bankrupt if the controlling stock.
Well, I'm asking for a legal principle. You know, give it to me in two sentences if you can.
A finding of bankruptcy or insolvency prospect still requires the trial court to apply an entire fairness assessment of the fairness of the price engineered by the 1,600-pound gorilla in the recap. The valuations done in this case were wrong, and the trial court erred as a matter of law in accepting the wrong valuations and not performing an independent valuation. I'll defer the balance of my time for a rebuttal.
May it please the court, Gregory Williams for the special committee defendants. Your Honors, it's very important to understand at the outset what is not at issue in this appeal. The plaintiff has not appealed from the court's factual findings that led the court to conclude that the recapitalization was the result of a fair process. This court's rules state that you must make clear in your opening brief what it is you're appealing. You have to make clear what you're attacking in the lower court's decision. And in that brief, and in the reply brief, there is not an appeal from the court's findings that led to the holding and finding of a fair process. There has also been no appeal from the court's finding that the plaintiff has the burden of proof on fairness. The reason, of course, the plaintiff has the burden of proof on fairness is because there was, as found by the trial court, an effective special committee. There could be no credible appeal from those findings. As the court found below, the special committee met 29 times over 9 months. It was not just any special committee. It included two members who were true experts in this industry. One founded ESPN and was the chair of the History Channel and A&E. Another had been the president of CBS. How often do you have such expertise in special committees? They had personally participated in the ongoing efforts to find a buyer for this company. And the Court of Chancery found, and there has been no appeal, that the committee was, quote, thorough, effective and independent, that's from page 43, and engaged in, quote, intense negotiations that were appropriately adversarial. That's page 39.
I gather your point is that the only element of the Court of Chancery's decision that is being appealed from is the fair price determination.
That's all that is appealed, Your Honor. And of course, we know the case law tells us that a fair process leads into a fair price, that those two analyses are not completely separate. Here we also had, Your Honor, and this does go to fair price. There's a lot of talk about our banker here this morning. The committee was represented by Morgan Stanley, and not just Morgan Stanley, by Rob Kindler, the global head of M&A at Morgan Stanley, who personally conducted the negotiations. It would be, I would submit, an extremely rare case where you could have such a fair process as found by the lower court and not appealed, with that process yielding an unfair price, and this is not that case. This is instead a recap that was badly needed, a recap that enabled public stockholders from having something worth no value to having a security with real value. Now, let me just also speak to the arguments that are made over here with respect to the experts. If you're the party that has the burden of showing fair price, as the appellant is, and if you had one expert who testified below that the recap was unfair, only one expert, that was Mr. Schechter, he's the only one who gave that testimony to the court, you would think at the very heart of your appeal would be a defense of Mr. Schechter's methodology and an attack on the lower court's rejection of his methodology. That's not present here. You would think you would be saying, here's how my expert arrived at that $3 billion valuation. Here's why it was right. You didn't hear that. And if you look at the summary of argument in the plaintiff's opening brief, and the court's rules require that you fairly summarize your argument, you'll see there's no mention, no reference, no allusion at all to Mr. Schechter and his analysis. Instead, there's the bankruptcy point, there's a criticism of Morgan Stanley and Houlihan Lokey, and there is a claim that there is a bright line rule in Delaware law, which simply doesn't exist, prohibiting the lower court from considering expressions of interest, offers, etc., as part of its evidentiary record. But not one mention of Mr. Schechter, and there were findings below that do not appear at all in their brief of critical defects in Mr. Schechter's analysis. All he did, keep in mind, Your Honors, was a discounted cash flow study. He actually did two other studies, comparable transactions and comparable companies.
Well, Mr. Williams, just so to make sure I understand where you're going, I gather, and tell me if I'm wrong, that even if all of Mr. Abrams' arguments about value were, or about insolvency were correct, he still has to meet his burden of proof with affirmative evidence that the court accepts in order to win a reversal. And that didn't happen here.
That's exactly correct, Your Honor. And to me, it's a glaring absence in their brief that is, to me, easily understood, but hard to understand in another way. That's exactly right. If you look at the court below, all Schechter had was a discounted cash flow analysis, and the court throws out Schechter's projections of cash flows on two independent grounds. First, the court finds, as a matter of fact, I am convinced that management's projections and carefully crafted and reasonable, and found, as a matter of fact, that Schechter had, quote, no legitimate reason for abandoning management's projections. Instead, what he did was he came up with his own projections. And the court, as a matter of fact, found you can't do that because these management projections are careful, they're conservative, you should have used them. On appeal, no discussion of that. You won't find it in the briefs at all. You didn't hear it this morning.
Mr. Williams, let me ask you a question.
Yes.
About your earlier statement just before Justice Jacobs' question that framed Mr. Abrams' argument a bit differently than I understood it about the significance of the offers that Morgan Stanley and Houlihan Lokey relied upon. I didn't understand him to be arguing there was a bright line rule that you can't consider expressions of interest or offers. I took his argument to be that the ones that exist in the record in this case were not close enough in time or serious enough to be considered at the time of the recap.
I think you will see, Your Honor, in his papers, they do articulate a bright line that they have to have been within a certain time period. They have to have been not just offers, they have to have been agreed upon. He says
or negotiated.
Or negotiated. There have to be certain fundamental points. If these points aren't present in those other indications of interest or offers, the court cannot consider them. And it's very important. That is, I believe, their position. And let me just say this. It's very important to keep in mind the purpose for which the chancellor looked at those prior offers. He wasn't saying, well, I believe the company is worth the amount of money that Fox offered. What he was saying is, put yourself in the trial court's position, if you would. I have one valuation from the plaintiff, which is $3 billion, supported only by discounted cash flow analysis. Am I required to put on blinders as to the real world, as to what really informed market players have been willing to pay for this company? He didn't value the company based on those numbers, but what he did was, in fact, say, I'm going to look at these as a cross-check. And that's completely appropriate under our law. Weinberger says that the trial court should consider all relevant evidence, and the trial court makes the determination as to relevancy. And, Your Honor, I know lived this this issue himself in the Gilbert case, Gilbert versus MPM, where the Supreme Court asked, Your Honor, when you were in Chancery, did you, as a matter of law, feel that you needed to not consider prior offers? And you ruled on remand, no, that's not true. I considered the evidentiary value of the prior offers and determined not to give them any credence here. So they do say that it was error as a matter of law for the court to consider those prior offers, and all the court did was look to the real world as a cross-check to one expert who threw out management's projections, projected cash flows out for 14 years. The court held, as a matter of fact, that's unreasonable. Management can't see that far. We don't know how you could. And said it's worth $3 billion. For the court to be required below to put on blinders seems to me to be exactly the wrong direction for Delaware law. Your Honor, I also want to go to...
I think on that point, as I understand what you're saying, is if someone is saying a company's worth $3 billion, and the fact of the matter is no one's coming forward to buy it for anything less when you know it's for sale, you have to wonder if it really is a $3 billion company.
It's certainly something that you do have to wonder about, Your Honor, and it's something that a trial court should consider. And let me say one thing about market check and what was known. It wasn't just after a deal was agreed to that the market was told that this company was considering alternatives. There is a press release that went out. It's a July 14, 2009 press release from Crown Media after the special committee was appointed, and it says, the special committee, with the assistance of Morgan Stanley, is considering Hallmark Card's proposal as well as the company's other alternatives. The marketplace knows what that means. They had shopped this company back in 2005, and when you say in a press release that the company is considering its alternatives, anyone who wants to buy this company can come forward, and there's no reason to think that if this hockey stick phenomenon that plaintiff's expert testified to, that any cable channel, in essence, after you go through the difficult first couple years and put your fixed costs in, then it's going to take off like a hockey stick. If that were true, one of these sophisticated players would have come forward and bought this company. And, in fact, Hallmark would have taken the company private when the special committee went to it and said, we know you want to do a recap. We'd like you first to consider taking this company private. Own all the equity. In plaintiff's words, you can have the whole hockey stick. Hallmark said, no thanks. We don't want to invest more money in this company. And so where are we? We have an appeal without any challenge to the factual findings that lead to fair process. No dispute that the plaintiff has the burden of proof on fairness. An expert who had one analysis, DCF, he rejected his other two because they were absurdly low, and the fundamental critical part of a DCF analysis, of course, are your projected cash flows. As a matter of fact, the court ruled that those projections that his expert came up with were not reliable. That's not appealed from, not mentioned in the papers. So what does the plaintiff do? It tries to invent errors of law, and there is not a requirement in our law, nor has there ever been, that the Chancery Court make its own independent valuation in an entire fairness case. This is not an appraisal case. Appraisal case is a creature of statute. Statute says the court must appraise fair value. Not true in an entire fairness case. It's a completely different regime. One side has the burden of proof. If that side doesn't satisfy its burden of proof, it loses. Court doesn't have to do anything else. And of course, that's what happened in Conn versus Lynch, the seminal case of Conn versus Lynch. There, the Court of Chancery, Justice Berger, sitting by designation, ruled that the transaction was entirely fair without finding a specific valuation or range of values. And this court affirmed, holding, quote, the Court of Chancery was not persuaded that Conn had presented evidence of sufficient quality to prove the inadequacy of the merger price. We find that ruling to be logically determined and supported by the evidence and accordingly affirmed. I have just a few seconds, and, Your Honors, I would say this in sum. This case was tried before a very experienced jurist who has viewed the work of probably hundreds of special committees. He has certainly analyzed hundreds of expert reports addressing valuation issues. After a four-day trial, extensive cross-examination on all the points you heard about today, he held that this committee achieved a, quote, great result for the public stockholders. We respectfully submit that the decision below should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Martin Tully for the Hallmark Defendants. I'd like to first address the Chief Justice's question. Were these other expressions of interest or valuations stale, as the plaintiff asserts? The fact is that the most recent valuation that Fox offered, now Fox had the same projections that the plaintiff's expert had. Unlike plaintiff, it met with management. It met with Hallmark. It owns broadcast and cable networks. 1 month before the recap was put on the table, it put a $500 million offer on the table. 1 month. And that was at the end of a process that began with the full support of Hallmark in 2005 to solve this liquidity problem. Hallmark's financing came about as bridge financing because there was no equity available in the market for a company that had never made a profit and was faced. We all know what happened in the cable industry in the last 10 years. It went from 50 channels to the bewildering 1,000 channels we have now. It went from standard format to high definition. It's now got increasing demands from outside services like Hulu and Roku and everything else. The amount of money that needed to be invested was enormous. During the period up to 2005, it did have bank financing in the range of $300 million. The banks looked at the track record and said, we're not doing this anymore. Hallmark, you're going to have to do it. You're going to have to fully guarantee all of our bank debt. And this is all in the SEC filings, they're all in the record. You're going to have to guarantee $300 million. You're going to have to loan them another $75 million. You're going to have to guarantee a revolver if you think you're going to get anything from us. Hallmark said, okay, but we better look at how we can solve this. That's when the waivers began in 2005.
And there is a financial incentive for these waivers, isn't there?
Well, the financial incentive for Hallmark was that there was the hope that a sale process would produce a repayment of the debt, which the company was forecasting it could not do. It would provide some equity for the public shareholders who came into the picture in 2000. There was a committee process, as the court below heard plenty of testimony from the independent directors who were involved that went on for several years. No offers materialized, but the analysis of industry players was it's not worth more than the debt. Then they brought in a new CEO in 2008, and they gave him a $6 million potential bonus if he could sell the company. He had just tried successfully to sell Court TV. It was big news in the industry. He was well known in the industry. Two of the special committee members were also giants of the industry. They all went out with Hallmark's full support to try to sell the company. CBS looked at it. Most importantly, Liberty Media, which owns cable channels and is headed by John Malone. I'm sure this court has seen Mr. Malone and knows he doesn't leave a dime on the table. He looked very hard from 2007 through the summer of 2008, only 6 months or so before the recap was proposed. In the discovery sought by plaintiff, they produced the internal DCF valuations that Malone's people did, and it showed that in their view, Crown was not worth more than the debt. And that's doubly important because Liberty owns more stock, more of the Class A stock that the plaintiff owns, twice as much as the plaintiff, has had a representative on the Crown board to protect its interests. It testified, its representatives testified at the deposition in this case that the company was not worth more than the debt, in their view, and that the terms negotiated by the special committee, which were a major improvement from the terms originally proposed by Hallmark, that those terms were fair, that they directed their representative to vote for it, and that they were happy with the result. Well, and that is not stale testimony.
There is one rejoinder that I'd like you to address, and that is this, that even though it's a matter of addition and subtraction, the dollar value of the debt was higher than the dollar value of the assets, which meant that the equity was worth nothing. Nonetheless, in the negotiated recapitalization transaction, Crown agreed in effect, to credit the equity with the worth of $500 million as a starting point for the negotiations. That is to say, it was willing to start from the premise that the equity was worth at least $500,000. Why would it do that if there were no, if in fact there were no value to the equity?
Well, the reason that happened and the reason that Hallmark agreed to it was Hallmark debt was all senior secured. So if there were foreclosure or bankruptcy, then Hallmark stood to gain everything. The equity stood to gain nothing. The testimony from Hallmark's CEO and CFO, who testified, unlike the plaintiff's principal, they made the point, and they were subject to cross-examination, and the court evaluated their credibility, that there were, they reviewed with counsel all the alternatives as soon as that Fox offer landed on the table, and they had seen all the prior people turn away. They reviewed all their alternatives. They said bankruptcy is the last resort because it's going to wipe out the public shareholders. That's bad for them. It's bad for us. It's not a result, having been the controlling stockholder in this company, that we would like to see. The reason we can all prosper in a recap is we're going to take the overhang of this debt off the company. They had been advised, and this was the testimony, if you could get the debt load down to $500 million, then there was a real prospect that you could find third-party financing. That would take out the $500 million of remaining debt and preferred stock. And, in fact, that's what's happened in this case. so that now the company is able to stand on its own. There's no controlling stockholder debt overhang. Everyone thought that, including Morgan Stanley and Hallmark, that if that could be achieved and the company could service a small amount of debt, that in the future the company could be sold and that all equity holders, including Hallmark, could benefit. They're not there yet, but that was the plan, and that's what they tried to do.
Let me see if I can put what you said into different words and tell me if I have it right.
Right.
You're saying that in exchange for giving the equity holders a guaranteed value of $500 million now, Crown was willing to roll the dice on future events in the hope that that credit could be monetized in the real world?
Well, I think that the way I would put it, Your Honor, and the way Morgan Stanley analyzed it, if we assume the Fox threshold of $500 million and we can get the debt to that point, then everybody on the equity side participates above $500 million. That includes the public 10% and our 90%. So in that scenario, I think Morgan Stanley was right and Hallmark was correct to agree to the terms. It's a better future than the risks of bankruptcy for the public, where the only testimony in the record is that if there was a bankruptcy, there was likely to be no value to the equity. And Hallmark stood to gain, at least on its secured assets, what value there was in the company. I'd say a couple of things quickly on the insolvency point. The court cited the testimony of the expert Schechter as well as Mr. Muoio's deposition. They both agreed the company could not pay even the interest when due for years to come, let alone the principal. Even with the increased cash flow that came about because of Mr. Schechter's unique projections, they couldn't pay the principal for another 20 years. The Hallmark witnesses said, "We meant what we said. We were not going to put $1 billion of Hallmark's capital at risk for another 20 years. We didn't have the obligation to do it. This was always bridge financing. We tried to sell the company. The company had our full support. We used independent directors and advisors to try to do it. This is the best result, a recapitalization." Thank you.
I asked in my opening argument for answers to a number of questions, and I didn't hear any response to my invitation for the defendants to explain why they didn't put any independent expert report valuing the company as of the recap date into the record. That is a clear failure of proof on their side, and I believe under Kahn versus Lynch and Van Gorkum, that the defendant's failure to introduce any evidence on the point when strong evidence should have been able to support their position should lead this court and should have led the trial court to the conclusion that only weak or counterproductive evidence would have been available.
So you're saying now they had the burden of proof?
The burden, we think the process issue should have come out differently in the trial court, but even if we bore the burden of proof, they had no competent evidence on their side. We had the only expert report. Our expert report was either right or should have been independently analyzed by the court to form its own fair price evaluation as of the recap date. These people put in nothing in the record. The burden of proof issue is irrelevant in virtually any case. I can't think of it, and I'd be shocked if there is one out there. I don't know of a decision turning on the burden of proof issue, because burden of proof only answers the question of what do you do if the two sides are in equipoise. Here, if you take Schechter's valuation and you correct for the mistakes that were clearly done on an objective basis by Morgan Stanley and Houlihan, the valuation comes out at Schechter's number. So our point is that the lower court erred as a matter of law in using outdated, irrelevant, and mistaken valuations and irrelevant offers from people trying to steal the company to totally reject Schechter. I heard no answer to my invitation for the defendants to explain how this equity could be deemed worthless if a controlling stockholder was willing to exchange $847 million of debt. I heard no answer to the question on the alternative argument with respect to the coercion that was explicit, not implicit. You've always been worried about the implicit coercion point. This is explicit coercion. If this decision is not overturned, I respectfully suggest that entire fairness cases are lottery tickets. The decision is fatally inconsistent with all other rulings and the focused inquiry that is traditionally done. We respectfully request a remand to allow a fresh look at this case. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.